Hello there and welcome. Today is Monday, April 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up...
This is a rogue regime that is now a nuclear-capable regime.
Donald Trump wants options to end North Korea nuclear threat. The president's aides say the U.S. will strike Syria again if necessary. Why this food is becoming a huge seller in U.S. grocery stores.
It revs up your metabolism. It also acts as an antiviral, antibacterial, antifungal.
Also ahead, a new social media network looking to compete with Twitter. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, following last week's U.S. airstrikes on a Syrian military airfield in the aftermath of that chemical attack on civilians, there are mixed signals from the Trump administration on the priority of removing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from power. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson telling CBS's Face the Nation that defeating Islamic State is still the paramount U.S. goal in Syria.
This strike, I think the president was very clear in his message to the American people that this strike was related solely to the most recent horrific use of chemical weapons against women, children, and as the president said, even small babies. And we're asking and calling on Bashar al-Assad to cease the use of these weapons. Other than that, there is no change to our military posture.
Well, VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has been monitoring the political impact of the U.S. attack and shared his observations with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
Jim, Syria has been a conundrum for the United States and for the international community for quite a long time. And in fact, President Trump, before entering the White House, had been critical of the Obama administration in many ways. But he's discovering, I think, that this is a very tough nut to crack. The chemical attack very much was something that crossed President Obama's red line, stated red line. President Obama really didn't do anything in response to that. But President Trump, who has very much said that the United States is not going to get involved in foreign wars that don't directly affect the United States, did order this attack, this strike of several dozen cruise missiles from the Mediterranean. And now the question is, what does this mean? Is there a huge shift in policy? Is President Trump, I mean, obviously he's learning on the job, but if he's reached any sort of conclusions on Syria, what does this mean?
Does firing missiles from the Mediterranean constitute getting involved militarily, or is this a message?
Well, it's certainly a message, and it's interesting because it's a message that's directed at an ally of Russia. At a time when there's been all this speculation about Russian influence in the United States, and you could almost see this argument in the White House that maybe this is killing several birds with one stone. You're sending Bashar al-Assad a message, but you're also showing that you're not afraid to do something that will be offensive to Moscow and showing independence from what Moscow might desire. And if nothing else, it certainly has knocked the Russia investigation off of the headlines for a couple of days. So in a sense, I suspect that this was a very attractive option to the White House. But there are questions going forward, and we see these questions playing out almost at the same time as Donald Trump's representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, was on one U.S. television network saying that President Assad is an impediment to peace in Syria. You had his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, on a different U.S. network saying that, well, of course, we don't necessarily want regime change because we saw how that went in Libya and it didn't go so well and we don't want a repeat of that in Syria. So there does seem to be some mixed messaging there. Obviously, the situation in Syria is very complicated. I mean, you have the Islamic State there, and the United States very much wants to get rid of the Islamic State. So does the Assad regime. But the Assad regime has carried out these horrible attacks on civilians and against moderate elements that want to overthrow him. This is not a sort of easy policy challenge to overcome.
All right. That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking to Jim Stevenson. Another volatile region of the administration is keeping a close eye on is on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has sent the warship Carl Vinson Strike Group to safeguard U.S. interests in the Western Pacific. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster telling Fox News on Sunday that President Trump has asked officials to give him options for removing the threat of a nuclear-armed North Korea.
This is a rogue regime that is now a nuclear-capable regime. And President Xi and President Trump agreed that that is unacceptable, that what must happen is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And so the president has asked us to be prepared to give him a full range of options to remove that threat to the American people and to our allies and partners in the region.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Korean expert with RAND Corporation senior defense researcher Bruce Bennett why the administration might have decided to send in the Carl Vinson warship.
Well, I think he wants to look across the possibilities. We talk about it as a naval strike group. It is also a naval missile defense group. And so it brings a number of capabilities with it that the president could potentially use. And I think that's what he wants to have a clear idea about.
So what would he do? Would he shoot down another missile test if it's to be launched?
Well, I think that having three more ships with that kind of capability up in the Sea of Japan, East Sea area, would give him that option potentially, yes.
What message does it send to not just the North, but China?
Well, I think the message we would send to the North would be that the UN Security Council resolutions have banned you from doing this. And now if you do them, not only will you be violating the sanctions, but you will force us to stop you from doing it by shooting your missiles down. To China, of course, this would be a message that said, look, we tried to get you to take economic actions against the North, and you preferred that we take military action. Sorry we had to do that, but it was your choice.
This comes just days after President Trump met with his Chinese counterpart.
They tended to indicate after the meeting that they established personal relations, but not much in terms of a business agenda for the future. So we could see unilateral U.S. action.
What would China's reaction be, do you think?
Really hard to tell. The Chinese government, as I understand it, has been split on this whole subject. Shooting down a North Korean missile does not jeopardize the North Korean regime. That's the issue China's most concerned about. So Xi Jinping, the leader of China, he's probably going to feel like, well, this is aggressive U.S. behavior, but not something we're going to be as upset about as other things the U.S. could have done.
Secretary of State Tillerson on television Sunday said the missile strike on Syria was a message to others, including Pyongyang.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case, but you have to look at the strike on Syria. As I understand it, we sent 50 cruise missiles into a single airfield to attack that airfield. How many airfields would we have to attack in North Korea and missile bases and nuclear storage sites to be able to eliminate the North Korean nuclear capability? And do that set of ships and the ships in the Seventh Fleet have enough missiles to do that?
So you're saying this is not really a message?
They have a surgical strike capability with those naval strike groups, but taking out the North Korean nuclear program is probably not something you do with the surgical strike.
Where does the situation now with regard to the missile and nuclear capability of North Korea stand right now in your view?
Well, I think North Korea poses a very dangerous capability. It does not yet have a missile which it can fire at the U.S., apparently, but it does have missiles that it could fire at South Korea or Japan or China, and those missiles could potentially carry nuclear weapons. So it's pretty dangerous already, and only getting more so over time if we let it continue to test.
The 105th birthday of Korea's founding leader is coming up April 15th. Is that a day that we should watch closely?
Oh, I think there are several dates coming up that we should watch closely. April is kind of the golden month for North Korea of having lots of events. So, yeah, this next period of time is a dangerous period.
That's VOA's Victor Beatty speaking with Korean expert with the RAND Corporation, Bruce Bennett. Here are some of the stories that we are following at voanews.com. 44 people killed, dozens wounded in Egypt church bombings. Another Trump aide set to leave the National Security Council. Secretary Tillerson heads to Moscow days after the U.S. missiles strike in Syria and anger Russia. And Christians across the globe celebrate Palm Sunday. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, amid all the other breaking world news, this story went a bit under the radar last week. President Trump signed a bill into law that could eventually allow internet providers to sell information about their customers' browsing habits. The bill scraps a Federal Communications Commission online privacy regulation issued in October to give consumers more control over how companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon share that information. Critics have argued that the rule would stifle innovation and pick winners and losers among internet companies. Here to talk more about what it all means is Mark Grabowski, internet law and ethics professor at Adelphi University in New York. Thanks for being with us. So what exactly does this change?
In a word, nothing is really changing. You didn't have online privacy to begin with, so you're not losing anything. What had happened was the Federal Communications Commission under President Obama had adopted new privacy rules that were set to go into place, but the new legislation stops that from happening. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be a big deal that I think a lot of the media is focused on Trump and Russia, and the people who are aware of this, they're kind of just resigned to the fact that online privacy doesn't exist. I think we're going to see more of this to come, that net neutrality is probably going to be next on the chopping block.
What was the point of reversing the rules if they don't change anything?
I mean, this is kind of like the reality we live in now, where your cell phone provider, the websites you visit, they all have access to all of your data, you know, who you call, who you send emails to, what you do, what terms you're searching for when you're using their website. So the ISPs came to the administration and said, well, this isn't fair. You know, everyone else is allowed to intrude upon your policy. Why did you create these special new rules that are going to keep us from getting the same information? So, you know, they saw it as a matter of fairness. And really, it's about the bottom line, because there's a lot of money to be made in having access to this information. You know, they can go and sell this data, what you do when you're using their internet service, which websites you visit, which terms you're searching for, who you email, which products you buy. They can sell that information to the highest bidder. Usually it's going to be marketers who are interested in reaching certain target demographics.
It's not really anything we should be super upset about or worried about at this point.
That's debatable, because what's going to happen is you're going to see more and more targeted ads when you surf online. So, for example, if your kid's teacher emails you that he's struggling in algebra, you might see ads about tutoring services. Or if you do a Google search for flights to Paris, expect to see ads from airlines and for hotels. So in some ways, that could arguably be a good thing, since you'll see more relevant targeted ads. On the other hand, it is a bit creepy, and I think people are worried that it could lead to some abuse. There's concern that the information could fall into the wrong hands, that, you know, it's going to be sold probably to the highest bidder. Will they sell it to foreign governments or to criminals? And I think people, they are worried that, you know, they sort of just see like these sort of worst case scenarios, and they worry that people might be able to use their data to extort or embarrass them. I think, though, that some of these fears are probably a bit overblown. There's some misinformation about this. You know, you can't go and buy, for example, a particular person's browsing history. And we have existing laws, such as the federal wiretap law, which I think would prevent serious abuses from happening. So if ISPs sort of see this as a green light to begin all kinds of new surveillance, and I think they might find themselves getting sued. They might, you know, there could be class action lawsuits against that type of abusive stuff.
All right, that's Mark Grabowski, internet law and ethics professor at Adelphi University in New York. Thanks so much for your time. Well, in the U.S. state of Augusta, Georgia, veteran Spanish golfer Sergio Garcia finally captured his first major title, winning Sunday's Masters Championship in Augusta in a sudden-death playoff over Britain's Justin Rose. Garcia finally broke through his 71st major as a professional in nearly 18 years after he was runner-up to Tiger Woods in a breakthrough performance in the PGA Championship. It was a fairy tale-like story because Garcia's first major golf championship came on what would have been the 60th birthday of his idol, Seve Ballesteros, his fellow Spaniard and former world number one who won 5 major championships. Ballesteros died 6 years ago from brain cancer. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. We've got so much turmoil around the world, and one problem that seems to have been going on forever with no solution in sight is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And with that, two U.S. researchers, one Israeli, one Palestinian, are now working on a project called the Hope Map, a survey basically of how people in that conflict zone feel about the chances of the conflict ever ending. Joining me now is one of those researchers, Israeli Oded Adomi Leshem, PhD student at the School of Conflict and Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Tell us a little more about the project.
So the Hope Map project is a quantitative study that is aimed at measuring levels of hope for resolution among the Palestinian society and the Jewish-Israeli society. So we are going to, in many ways, it's an extensive public survey that taps Palestinian Israelis' hope for the future on a bunch of dimensions and definitions of resolution. And, of course, we're also going to capture people's demographic measures like age and gender, political orientation, etc. And we could also correlate and see if there is any correlation between these demographic measures and their levels of hope or peace on each of the dimensions.
Now, is the project in the works right now, or has it been completed?
Initial research has already been done and has actually been analyzed, and there are results from that project. But the major project that we're working on now is going to be done in the Palestinian territories and in Israel proper. So the first project was done only on Jewish Israelis, and now we're expanding the project to do it both in the Palestinian territories and, again, in Israel proper, also using much more elaborate methods to capture hope for a resolution. I think one of the most important things, as you stated, is that the hopes for resolution in Israel-Palestine are quite low. So these things have been shown in studies that people mired in this intractable conflict think that the conflict is innately irresolvable. So it can't be resolved by its very definition. This is a very pervasive belief among Jewish Israelis and Palestinian alike. But there are still about 50% that believe that peace is somehow likely, and we're going to try to tap these perceptions, understand first of all what they hope for, and also kind of pinpoint the exact dimensions of their hopes. For example, one could wish very much for peace but not expect it to come, or one could expect it to come but not wish it that much. There's also an emotional component to hope, and there's a behavioral component, and we're going to try to tap all of these measures and kind of build a very nuanced map of hope for a resolution.
Where does the issue of the settlements come in?
So settlers, for example, we are also going to try to get settlers and answer this survey. So it's going to be a survey done on representative samples, a sample of Palestinians and Israelis. So we're going to capture the whole range of political orientation, including settlements. Now, of course, settlements are a big obstacle for peace, but mainly what we're going to do is measure people's perceptions. So this is a survey about the perceptions about the future. Many times public surveys or public opinion polls, they try to measure people's understanding of policies or current events. We are trying to tap people's perceptions of the future, which is quite novel.
And what do you hope to achieve when this is all finished?
So there are two, I think, main products, the research that hopefully is going to be published in the academic world, but we are also going to disseminate the findings to decision makers, but also to the public. One of the important features of this project is that it is funded by the people, by Israelis, Palestinians, and others that are interested in the results. So we, in order to budget this project, we launched a crowdfunding campaign on generosity, and were really surprised by great interest that people have in this project and also their willingness to contribute money to make this happen.
All right, that's Odette Domi Leshem, PhD student at the School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution, George Mason University. Thanks for telling us about your project. Let's turn now to our social media segment, and for that we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Big talk about a new social network that is trying to supplant Twitter. Now, we've talked a lot on the show in the past about how Facebook borrows things from Snapchat, other social networks borrow from others. There's a lot of creative borrowing going on. Well, this one isn't just borrowing some of the ideas from Twitter. It wants to supplant Twitter, as I said, and be the new Twitter. It's called Mastodon, and it's a new network that operates much in the same way as Twitter, except there are some slight changes, and kind of funny when you put them side by side. They have, instead of tweets, they're called toots, because of course it's a mastodon,
really?
Like a, you know, the mastodon,
okay.
The big elephant,
okay.
Prehistoric
okay.
Elephant. Instead of retweeting, you boost posts. Instead of hearting a post or liking a post, you give it a star. And instead of having 140 characters to work with, you have 500. Now, the big difference between Mastodon and Twitter is that Mastodon is organized into different boards or communities, and they don't necessarily interact with each other. But Mastodon has gotten a lot of attention in the past few days as a lot of people have suddenly joined onto the social network. Huh. There's been a lot of frustration with Twitter and a lot of anger about some of the changes that Twitter has made recently. So that seems to be why people are jumping on this particular social network. It happens to be, it seems, the right place, right time kind of thing.
I wonder if the president will change over from his normal tweeting to tooting?
To tooting, yeah. Well, we'll see how popular this gets. One of the big reasons why people are moving over to Mastodon is because they pledge to really crack down on hate speech, harassment. In fact, that's their top policy, is that anyone who uses any kind of foul language or attacks anyone will instantly be removed. We'll see if it actually sticks around or if it's just a fad, but for the time being, it's attracting a lot of attention and a lot of new users.
Cool. Anything else worth talking about?
An interesting story, at least. As much as we're talking about Mastodon supplanting Twitter, Twitter still has millions of users,
yes,
and is still being consumed by millions around the world daily,
sure,
including a gentleman by the name of Carter Wilkerson. Now, he tweeted at Wendy's restaurants with a question: how many retweets for a year of free chicken nuggets? Now, a little bit of backstory. Wendy's has had great success recently with their Twitter account. They've been very sarcastic in replying to people. They've had really snappy answers. So they've got kind of a cult following just for their Twitter account, let alone the restaurant. So Wendy's replied to Carter Wilkerson, said to get a year of free chicken nuggets, he needed to have 18 million retweets. Now, to give you some perspective, the most retweeted tweet ever has about 3.3 million retweets. So 18 million would be...
That's a high goal.
It's a high goal. Carter Wilkerson, however, responded and said, consider it done.
Uh-oh.
And this was back late in the work week last week on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So far, in the course of about 4 days, he has over 2.1 million retweets. So
Whoa.
He's well on his
he
way.
He is.
After he tweeted out, he said, help me, please. A man needs his nuggets. And people are heeding that call. I don't know if he'll get to 18 million retweets, but this has become the kind of viral cause celeb for the moment being, people retweeting him, hoping that he can get a year's supply of chicken nuggets.
Well, you know, this does nothing for the vegetarians like me in the world.
No, it doesn't. But for the social media fiends and the fast food junkies, it's a great story for them. And I think it's kind of one of those underdog stories. Everyone's cheering on for this regular guy who just happened to tweet at the restaurant.
Yeah.
They responded, and now he's become a viral social media star.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Thanks so much, Andrew. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, more Americans are interested in consuming healthy food and products. Retailers are feeding this growing demand by offering new products or introducing old ones in brand new ways. And coconut is one of the hottest new trends in the U.S. food market. VOA's Faiza El-Masri has more, with Face Lapidus narrating.
Coconuts have been around for years, but over the last few years, coconut oil and water have gained popularity, with more coconut-related products appearing on supermarket shelves. There's a reason coconut has become one of the top food trends for 2017.
It revs up your metabolism. It also acts as an antiviral, antibacterial, antifungal. So it's great for the immune system. It's great for the heart. It raises your HDL. And it also is great for, like, any kind of urinary tract infections, any kidney issues, weight. I mean, the possibilities of using coconut oil for your health is endless.
So are the possibilities for other parts of the coconut.
We're seeing coconut oil in natural beauty products. We're also seeing things like the meat of the product being used in everything from flours to tortilla chips to milks and butters.
That means more coconut-based businesses are thriving. Conscious Coconut is a Florida-based company. Its coconut oil products are sold in around 650 stores, and CEO Daniel Conte is showing its new travel tube here at the LA Gift and Home Market Show.
It is extremely popular. When I started Conscious Coconut, I like to say that cocoa wasn't cool yet.
There's not much research into coconut oil's health benefits. Unlike other plant-based oils, it is a saturated fat, which has been linked to heart disease. While it does raise good HDL cholesterol, it also elevates bad cholesterol, which also increases the risk of heart disease. While it might not be the wonder food its promoters claim, it's expected that coconut products will continue to attract shoppers' attention and money. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thanks so much for joining us. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a fabulous day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the month of April, the United States has assumed the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council. Speaking recently at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York, U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Ambassador Nikki Haley, said one of the vital issues the United States intends to put on the Security Council's agenda this month is the role human rights abuses play in the breakdown of international peace and security. For too long, she said, peace and security were considered the Security Council's purview, while human rights were kept separate and left to others. The fact is, she noted, peace and security cannot be achieved in isolation from human rights. In case after case, human rights abuses are not the byproduct of conflict, they are the cause of conflict, or they are the fuel that feeds the conflict. Desperate people robbed of their humanity and subject to humiliation and abuse inevitably want revenge, Ambassador Haley said, and they are also vulnerable to manipulation or coercion by extremist groups. In North Korea, she pointed out, human rights abuses literally provide some of the financing for aggression. Political prisoners are forced to work themselves to death in coal mines to finance the regime's nuclear program. In other cases, such as Syria, human rights abuses are used as weapons of war. The Assad regime, Ambassador Haley said, uses torture, including the deliberate, systematic torture of children, to identify and silence opponents. Pro-government forces in Syria have systematically targeted civilian infrastructure, including hospitals. Assad's crimes have led to the greatest refugee crisis since World War II. What was once a brutal crackdown on peaceful protesters, she added, is now a six-sided conflict and a great power proxy war. The time has come for the Security Council to explicitly consider the connections between human rights and security, Ambassador Haley said. This debate is one that's worth having. It would greatly strengthen the work of the Security Council, and it's the right thing to do. Ambassador Haley observed, it will be very telling if any country tries to block this debate. It's past time that the Security Council acknowledge the importance of human rights abuses and demand that its member nations do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.